Hello and welcome to the Text and Academic Authors Association teleconference, A Coach's Perspective on Finishing a Dissertation, moderated by Dave Harris. Dave's company, Thought Clearing, provides dissertation coaching and academic editing. He received a BA in economics from UC Berkeley, an MA in English Literature from San Francisco State University, and a PhD in Design Theories and Methods from the Department of Architecture at UC Berkeley. It was Dave's study of design, and specifically the designer's process of moving from a problem to a solution and thinking about different ways of approaching difficult projects, that laid the foundation for his becoming a dissertation coach. You can visit Dave's website at www.thoughtclearing.com. I will email all the participants Dave's contact information following the teleconference if you want to get in touch with him. And I now turn the teleconference over to Dave Harris.
Hi, thank you, Kim. I'm Dave, and Kim has so nicely introduced me that I won't say any more about myself. I would actually like each of you who's here with us today to briefly introduce yourself and maybe say a little bit about what you're hoping to get from the conference, because I think that one important thing about working on your dissertation is that there's a whole bunch of different angles to look at it from, and I have put many things in the outline, but I don't know that I'll necessarily have got what you wanted in the outline. So if you can tell me a little bit about what you're hoping to hear, that would be great. And I'll just call out your names. I don't know exactly whether anybody has come on, so I'm just going to call all five names, the first of which is Erzsébet Fazekas. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Hi, yes, this is me, Erzsébet. Nice to meet you. So I'm in the last stretch of my dissertation process. I'm supposed to finish really soon, but what happened with me is that I still miss a large chunk of my dissertation, and I'm suddenly starting to have problems with my advisor. So I'm hoping to learn here how to get through this last stage.
Okay, thank you. Suzanne Cook.
Hi, I'm in my second year of my program, and I've started to collect data for my thesis. And I'm a bit overwhelmed with my qualitative data and want to also add some quantitative data to it and then try to write the whole thing up and make linkages and connections and hopefully publish some pieces off of that. So that's the stage that I'm at right now.
Okay, great. Thank you, Suzanne. Anissa Hussein? Maybe Anissa has not called in. Irina Weisblatt?
Yes, hello, this is Irina Weisblatt. I'm the first year doctoral student, and I just started working on the first chapter of my dissertation. So I'm at the stage when I'm still, first of all, of course, collecting the data and the literature, and the dissertation is in educational area. It's about the basic skills for the global economy. Since I'm teaching at the community colleges here in San Diego. And, of course, I have very many questions since I just started, but the most important thing that I would like to make clear for myself is sort of, I think that my dissertation will go into quantitative research, and I would like to see the differences between quantitative and qualitative research. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Vicky Cook? Vicky also might not have called in. I'm not hearing from Vicky, so maybe I'm just going to go ahead and start in. And I hadn't really planned so much on talking about the academic side of the dissertation with quantitative and qualitative stuff, but maybe I will talk about that some too. My main idea is that there are many different ways to look at your dissertation, and maybe my main idea, I'm going to have several main ideas. There are a lot of different ways to look at it, and if you can keep those different perspectives active, and if you can use the different ways of looking at it to give you insight into your project and to help you see what it is that you're trying to accomplish, you can get to your goals soonest. So I wanted to just talk about different ways of looking at the project as a whole and the different aspects. I will talk some. I know Erisabeth was interested in issues with her committee. One important part. I'm just going to start briefly the introduction. I'm going to run through the outline that I gave. If anybody has any questions at any time, feel free to jump in. I'll stop at the end of each section briefly to ask if there are any questions. And I'm happy to answer questions. It's always best to tailor what you're doing to your audience, which is one of my points below. Okay, so section one, the what is a dissertation? And a dissertation can mean a lot of different things. People mostly think of their dissertation in terms of the hypothesis or thesis that they're trying to demonstrate or prove. And that is, of course, the main part of the dissertation, but there are other ways of looking at it. So I've included five different points, of which I've labeled four. One is the dictionary definition, a long essay on a particular subject, especially written as a requirement for a doctoral philosophy degree. That captures these four points below. Proof of academic achievement, right? When you've written this, this is offered to your committee as proof of your ability as an academic, and this is proof then that you are essentially their peer. One of the things that I think is important, and I'll mention this again later, is how we react and interact with our committee and with the rest of academic discourse. It's a demonstration of your individual research and thinking. So another point that I'll get to that's very important is how this is your work, this is your voice, and by finding your voice, you can bring yourself to a better and more successful goal. It's a book, or at least a draft of a book. When I was working on my dissertation, I worked with George Lakoff. I hear a beep that suggests somebody is coming in. So anyway, when I was working on my dissertation, I had the good fortune to study with George Lakoff, the metaphor theorist, and he said to us doctoral students, treat the dissertation as your book. If you're interested in becoming a tenure-track professor, you have to publish a book, or you have to publish, you know, some number of extra articles. And if you treat the dissertation as the first draft of your book, then you are not, you are working towards that goal in a longer sense, and at the same time, you're not bound by the idea that it has to be perfect in itself. It's the first draft. Finally, it's the project that allows you to receive a doctoral degree. I had a friend whose father was a professor who said, the PhD is just a license to research. By receiving your degree, you attain a certain status which allows you opportunities that you wouldn't otherwise have. And if you can do that, so it can serve many practical purposes. So the dissertation is all these things, and I think being able to keep these in balance is an important aspect, and especially with when I come to section three, the dissertation in your life, knowing these things. Before I come to that section, I wanted to talk just about some of the main principles, before I do that, are there any questions about what I just said, or did the person who just joined us, would you like to introduce yourself briefly?
Yeah, hi. I'm sorry I'm coming in late. I had some technical difficulties. My name is Anissa Hussein, and I'm a doctoral student at Loyola University Chicago, and I'm currently doing my PhD in school psychology, and I'm working on my dissertation.
Excellent. Thank you, Anissa. Greetings.
Hi.
Any questions, or should I just go on to my basic principles?
Okay, I just like to inject that the instruction, Anissa, muting yourself with 4-star, just to minimize any background noises since we are recording this. And then if you want to speak, you just press 4-star again, and that will unmute you.
So I have to press the star 4 times?
No, just press 4, and then star.
Oh. Oh, 4 and star. Okay, sure.
And then that again, if you want to speak.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Thank you and welcome. All right, go ahead, Dave.
Okay. Section two, basic principles. These are basic principles of academic writing, I said on your outline. These are practical principles. They're not ideals about what makes good academic work or how one goes about proving a point or qualitative or quantitative data or anything like that. These are things that you can put into your practice of writing. And the first one is to actually start writing. Writing is a process of learning, and the task of putting our ideas down on paper and on putting the things that we're thinking down on paper force us to engage with the material in a different way than when we just read. And so one of the most common things that I hear from people I'm working with is, oh, I haven't done enough research yet, I can't start writing. The truth of the matter is there's always new material published and there's already more out there than you can have read. You can research forever. If you don't start writing, you will never start writing. So you have to start. And in the process of writing, by the process of writing, you begin to see the work differently and it can help you focus your research immensely. So start writing. Start the process of getting your voice and getting your own words down onto the page. My second point is that you should recognize that academia is a discourse. And what I mean by this is that there are many voices out there and many different opinions. There are different theories about what is true, and there are different theories about how one proceeds academically. When you put your work into this discourse, which you hope to do by filing your dissertation with UMI Dissertation Publishing, by publishing papers in journals, by eventually publishing your dissertation as a book, you are putting yourself out into, your voice out into, this chaotic storm of voices. And some people are going to oppose what you have to say, and some people are going to agree. And this is true almost regardless of what you say. Whatever position you choose, there's going to be some. So if you can recognize this and recognize both that some people will support and some people will react in negative ways, that can strengthen you to engaging in a different way. It makes you less vulnerable to criticism in particular because you recognize no matter what you do, you're open to that. And so what you have to do is proceed with that. Also, by recognizing the discourse, you can help position yourself with respect to the people that you work with and agree with the best. So by doing that, you give authority to your work and you help your reader understand where your work is placed in the world of this academic discourse. So if you recognize that it is a discourse, that can help immensely in situating your own opinions. And that's number three here, or letter A, I suppose. Recognize that you're writing to an audience. This is a similar aspect. When you write, you are writing to people. You're not just writing to an individual, or you're not just writing about yourself. You're not just putting down your ideas as in a diary. You're trying to reach various people. Now, in a dissertation, the three or five or two most important people, of course, are your dissertation readers. But you want to also keep in mind a sort of a more ideal audience, so that when you discuss it with them, it's not cynically just saying, well, I'm trying to convince you, what do I need to write? You're thinking about, but by choosing an audience, you focus what you have to say. You choose what is going on to the page, and you choose the level of detail and the level of background that you have to give. The American Psychological Association publication manual says that you should assume your audience is knowledgeable. So you don't have to give an entire background and history of what you're doing if you're working with a knowledgeable audience. So know your audience and think about that. That can help you focus your writing in a different way than just focusing on, what's my topic? Okay. Recognize the recognize the non-topical aspects of the project. This is most of what I'm going to talk about. The rest, but it's not just your thesis, it's not just your dissertation, it's your life, it's how to get the right number of pages, it's how to get it all done, how to manage bureaucracy. Okay, choose a topic and be focused. Focus is so important. Without it, you wander around and you try this and try that. Whatever choice you make, there will be problematic aspects, and if you let the problems force you to another topic, then you have to start again. So you have to rush ahead, and I'm thinking that I'm wanting to rush ahead a little because I'm looking at the time and recognizing that I haven't even got. Okay, make decisions. For every, this is following up on choosing a topic and being focused. For every decision, there are pros and cons. No decision is perfect. So as a matter of course, you have to make a decision and sort of live with the costs of that decision, recognizing the difficulties, recognizing problems. If you can do this, then you can move forward and find the most beneficial solutions for you, the ones that help you make the most progress, instead of getting bogged down by saying, well, this isn't going to work. So I was talking with a client yesterday who has this wonderful support from his committee, who's helping him set up an experiment, who's providing him with this data, and he's saying to me, well, I don't know if I should proceed in this course of action because it's not exactly what I wanted to do, and it's not, I'm not sure that it's going to work. And, well, of course, it's very important to do something that you believe in and something you're interested in, but to not do something because you're not sure that it's whether it's going to work or not, that's just an obstacle to moving forward. You have to take the chance that it will or will not work and be open to it not working so that you can learn from it and move on. So making decisions and recognizing the pros and cons. Next one, preserve your health. Did I take this out? I took this out, so I'm looking at two different outlines. Know your priorities. Accept limitations. Make a practice. Two different outlines, excuse me. Make a plan of your entire project, letter F. The more you have a vision of what you're trying to accomplish as a whole in terms of who your audience is, in terms of how long it's going to be, in terms of what kind of data you're looking for, in terms of all of these different perspectives, the more you can get this well-rounded project envisioned in your mind, the better your opportunity of making plans that can help you move towards it. So you want to have a plan of what the entire thing is going to look like. You want to accept limitations. This is, again, pros and cons appear everywhere. If you can accept limitations, if you can recognize that there are problems with your research and say, ah, this is something that I write into the limitations section of my dissertation, rather than saying, ah, this is something that will keep me from moving forward, then you can proceed as quickly as possible because you're making choices and you're taking an active role. You're not allowing yourself to be victimized by perceived limitations. You're just recognizing them, accepting them. Finally, H, make a practice. The dissertation is a long, drawn-out process. If you finish it incredibly quickly, it takes you months. And if it takes you, if you finish it slowly, it could take you years. Many people work on their dissertation for several years or are all the dissertation for several years, many, many years before they finish their dissertation. And if you can make a practice of working, if you can make a practice that sustains your health, and this segues into section three, but I will stop briefly. If you can make a practice that promotes working regularly on your dissertation without giving in to the obstacles that will beset you, then you will finish in the quickest manner possible. Edison is known to have said that the genius is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. And to some extent, this is a wonderful metaphor for your dissertation writer. You write a chapter, it gets rejected by your committee for some reason. This is parallel to a broken filament in a light bulb that you're trying to invent. This is not reason to abandon the project. This is reason to learn from what happened and to try again in a different way so that you make, but you make a practice of it and persist. Does anybody have any questions before I go on to section three, which is the dissertation in your life? Okay. Number three, the dissertation is this huge part of people's lives, and it can occupy years and years of your life. It can occupy an eternity if you're one of the approximately 50% of graduate students who don't finish their PhD program. It can occupy the rest of your life. I've worked with people or talked with people who have been working on dissertations or who started their programs 20 years ago or more. In my program at Cal, the Department of Architecture, PhD students regularly take 10 years. I finished in 10 years. I took a couple of years off, but I was neither the first nor the last in my program to finish. So this is a huge chunk of your life. And you start into it with all sorts of great reasons. I wanted to be a professor. I wanted to teach. I really enjoy teaching. I know that many other people start in because they have a crusade of some reason, or they want to teach, or they have a subject that they're fascinated in. And then years later, they call me up and they say, boy, I'm just thinking of quitting, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And if you can keep an eye on where the dissertation fits in your life, then you can benefit from the process the most. One question I get a lot is should I do it at all? Should I finish it at all? And that's perhaps the most important question for somebody who's stuck. If you're working on it and having good progress, then it's less of an issue. And I think that I'll skip by that one to go on to my outline, which is point A, maintain your health. If this takes months or years, you want to engage in it in a practice, in a practical way that maintains your health. So, you know, good ergonomics is important, and recognizing how your stress levels are affected by your process. These are all very important things. Nothing really is more important than maintaining your health. And ideally, the dissertation is part of a goal to have a better life and to lead a better life. So if you compromise your health in order to complete your dissertation, this seems like, in the end, a mistaken application of your priorities, which brings me to number two, understanding your life's priorities. What the dissertation is really about is helping you lead a fulfilling life, right? We choose to pursue a dissertation because we want to be something. We want to accomplish this or accomplish that. We want to learn. We want to play specific roles. If we can understand that the dissertation fits within these priorities, it helps us make a decision that's best for us and helps us make a decision in terms of how long we want to take, how good a project we want it to be, how much we want to give into expediency in order to finish, all of these issues. But understanding why we're doing this, to understand, yes, I want to get a job. Yes, I don't want to live in debt. Yes, I want to be healthy. All of these very important for maintaining where you're going and keeping yourself working in your dissertation and in a way that's useful. If your dissertation is breaking down your life and you've got something better to do with your life, then you shouldn't do it at all. But hopefully it's going to lead to opportunities to do interesting things, opportunities to do good things in your life, and you want to maintain your health and your life to do that. Brings me to number C, finding meaning in your life and your dissertation. Viktor Frankl, the therapist who developed a brand of therapy or a branch of therapy called logotherapy, wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning. And it was largely about how he responded to his time in a concentration in a Nazi concentration camp and how he applied his wisdom from that to a type of therapy. He had been a psychiatrist prior to being imprisoned in Auschwitz. But his general principle was that even suffering is an opportunity for us to learn about meaning and to find meaning in things. And if we can find meaning in what we're doing, then it changes how we interact with it, and it gives us the power to move forward in a positive way. By finding meaning in life, that is how we live and how we live best. So he says he found meaning in the suffering in the camps. And clearly, we don't want to draw a parallel between the suffering of writing a dissertation and the suffering of the Nazi concentration camp, but I've heard many laments about what the dissertation is. If we can find meaning in it, it helps us. And I don't mean this on a grand tragic level, because, of course, if you're working on a dissertation, you're immensely privileged to have the luxury that you're probably not scrabbling for food and you're probably not scrabbling for survival. But nonetheless, we find despair in our own situations too often, or we find difficulty in our own situations. So if we have meaning and we understand what our dissertation means to us, then it's easier to proceed. So don't let people say, tell you expediency is the only thing. Understand what role the dissertation plays in your life and how that can help you. Finally, academic goals, right? These obviously serve you in these larger contexts of your life. The dissertation helps you get a PhD. It helps you tremendously in any academic endeavor. So I think that's all I'll say about academic goals. Before I go on to section four, finding your own voice, are there any questions or comments that anybody would like to throw in? Okay, point number four. Finding your own voice. The main point of the dissertation is your opportunity to express your own knowledge and your own wisdom and to demonstrate to your committee, and your committee stands in for the academic community at large, to demonstrate to them that you are a competent practitioner of the trade of research. This is essentially the academic's version of a bar exam or whatnot. This is your opportunity to show your professional competence. It is therefore should be based on your own voice and your own opinion. As I was saying about in the previous section about finding meaning in your life and in your dissertation, if you are using your own voice, this makes the project more meaningful. So don't think that the dissertation is just about reporting things. Consider the dissertation from the perspective of what it means to you and what significance you find in things. If you are doing a dissertation that's only a meta-analysis, only a study of other studies, you're not necessarily gathering any new empirical data, but what you are doing is you're providing a new understanding of what that data means. If you are working on literature, if you are working on quantitative data, if you are working on qualitative data, what is important is the meaning that you make from it and your understanding of what's important that you share with the academic community of which you're a part. This is what the dissertation is about. If you are thinking about your work in this way, it helps you understand the role of writing and helps you start writing. It helps you focus your process of research, because when you're researching, you're no longer just saying, well, you're not just interacting with each new article as a new idea that you're going to sort of explore. You're interacting with it as something that is evidence that helps you understand your own opinions and helps you refine your own opinions. It challenges your own opinions. It says, are my opinions standing up in the light of this new information? And if so, why are my opinions standing up in the light of this new information? Or if not, how does this new information change my opinions? Like, this is what the process of learning ideally is all about. So we're finding our own voice, and by recognizing that it's about creating our own understanding, then we have the best opportunity to get the most profit out of the process of our writing, which is a learning process, and our reading, which obviously is a learning process. Number two, in finding your own voice, I say that keep in mind that your overall objectives, keep in mind your overall objectives even when engaging in small tasks. So your dissertation is a task of presenting a coherent point of view, and one common theme that a lot of academic writing has is it falls into the details and then gets lost in the details, and it's hard to see how the details relate to the overall task. So as you write and as you engage in your individual research task, yes, I have to write a paragraph on this author, or yes, I have to write a section on this particular subject. As you engage in each of these detailed subjects, you're always keeping in mind how that individual subject relates. I care about this author because it shows me this aspect of my main point. I care about this specific topic because it shows me this. And this is something to both keep in your own mind and to put down on the page to help your reader orient your detail within the larger framework of your work. I don't know if any of you have ever read an academic work where there seems to be endless detail and it's hard to keep track of how that relates to the main thesis, but it's easy enough to create writing like that and easy enough to avoid it by keeping in mind your overall objective, even when you're writing about the small thing. Finally, I say solve problems by writing, not by researching. The answers are better found, I think, because you're looking for your own voice. They're better found by exploring your own ideas and trying to clarify your own opinions. If you sit down, if you're confused about a point, if you don't understand something or you think you don't know enough about it, if you sit down and write and sit down and engage in the process of trying to work out what you think and what you understand and the pieces of things that you're confident of and the places where you have questions, and you can start to unweave and unravel this web, that will help you focus your efforts and help you come to a development of your own coherent voice, which isn't just a response to other people, but is woven into the fabric of how you see the world and how you see the larger things around you. None of this idea of finding your own voice is contrary to the necessary of doing responsible research, but doing the reading, gathering data is not the only part of the academic process. Finding your own voice and finding your own interpretation and understanding of the data is what makes it so important. It's the people who have the great breakthroughs in how we look at the world that we find interesting. If we look at a history of scientific ideas like Thomas Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions, we find that it's not so much that the data and the evidence have changed that bring about changes in scientific revolutions, but it's what people did with the data and how they looked at it and how they turned it into something new. And so this is true for you too, even if we don't all aspire to create a scientific revolution. You should be aspiring to use the data in your way, and that is where the strength of your academic work will come from. If then your voice is founded on sound research. So that's what I would like to say about finding your own voice. Are there any questions about that?
It's Suzanne. I just wanted to say that I agree very much that those comments really resonate, and I find that in writing it does help me to be more reflective and help me to really clarify and communicate more effectively. So I do think that is a very important point that you make.
Great. I'd like to think also that it helps keep people, it helps you find confidence in what you're doing when you're writing your own idea. And I think that that's an important thing to be able to move forward and to say, oh, yes, my idea is this. And then to be able to reflect back out on the world and say, when you find somebody who agrees with you because of a position you've already found, that's so much more reassuring than just to sort of follow behind. Anyway, the next thing I want to talk about is the faculty committee. And this is often a big stumbling point. So what's the situation with the faculty committee? These are people that we're working with who are playing a number of different roles in their lives and in our lives, and therefore they can take on aspects which are difficult and challenging. I think the most important thing about the faculty committee is they're people, and it's easy to develop a relationship with our professors, sort of like our relationship with our parents, where we constantly refer to them for permission, and we constantly refer to them for wisdom, and we constantly refer to them for all these sort of parental things. And this gives them a sort of a godlike cast, in the same way that maybe our parents have this sort of godlike unapproachability, and we get over it with our parents sooner because we, you know, interact with our parents a lot more. But our professors, but you know, they're just people. They have their own personal interests and motivations. They have emotions. They're imperfect. And if you can remember this, this can actually help you manage them a lot, because you approach them differently. If you say, oh yeah, this is somebody who's overworked, and this is somebody who really has been trying to get their last book finished for, you know, 2 years, and this is somebody who's really excited about some other project than mine, or who's most interested in this aspect of my project, and I'm most interested in that aspect of my project. Right? If we keep in mind how they are people, and they have these interests and motivations and emotions and their imperfections, then we can use situations, we can make the right judgment on how to interact with the different people involved. So if you have a faculty member on your committee who's touchy, then you make good decisions on how to approach them to deal with their touchiness. And if you have somebody who's very critical, you understand that that criticism may not be just about you, but it's just a matter of their... So all of these things, I think, are really important to keep in mind when you're working with your committee. Because, B, they're your gatekeepers, right? You need to please these people more than anybody else. From one perspective, the whole task of the dissertation is to convince the people that they're going to sign that one piece of paper. And if your dissertation is one page long and you can get them to sign that piece of paper, you're done. That's sort of a cynical way of looking at it. But this means that your dissertation task is not just a process of getting them to read the dissertation itself and like it, but to interact with them in a way that helps them believe that you're ready to be done. So if you ask the right questions about their feedback, and if you ask the right kind of questions about their feedback, and you in other ways act like they would expect a responsible academic to act, then you grease the wheels and you give them extra reason to believe that what you've put on paper makes sense, right? If they read a sentence and they have no idea where you're coming from when you wrote that sentence, then they can interpret it in the most negative light possible. If you have just talked with them recently about what you're trying to accomplish and they read that sentence, it helps focus their understanding of that sentence, hopefully in your favor. So by generating a good outside interaction with them where they respect your way of handling the problem, you may be able to grease your wheels. Letter point C, theoretical agreement, theoretical stance. People are always easier to work with if you agree with their theoretical stance, and one has to be careful about trying to work with somebody who has an opposing theoretical stance to your own. There are people who will happily work with somebody with an opposing theoretical stance and can, within the context of saying, well, I don't agree with this theory, but I will recognize it as the foundation for this study. That can be good, but lots of people are going to just not be able to handle some different theoretical stance. So if you understand where somebody is coming from, that can really help you choose a committee member or choose whether it's worth changing a committee member that's giving you problems. Last part, getting feedback. Two aspects to this. One is how to get it, and the other is what to do with it when you get it. The first aspect is always a ponder. Your committee members are probably extremely busy people. I know that professors at Berkeley are grading papers, they're on committees, they're, you know, trying to hire the next faculty member, they're trying to write their own book, they're trying to manage a research project, they're trying, you know, they have all sorts of things, and to my experience, they're often working 12-hour days. So if you can recognize this and make a plan for interacting with that, it makes it easier to get feedback. and what elements of a plan would help. Schedule it. Tell them when you want to give them something and tell them when you hope to get feedback back. Tell them that you don't need to have necessarily extensive feedback, but to get even a hint of feedback will be good, right? If you reduce their sense of burden on giving you feedback, then they may give you something rather than nothing. Convince them that you're actually actively working on the project. So if they don't give you feedback on work that you've turned in, keep working and give them something new. Keep working and let them know that you are maintaining focus, you're moving forward on a specific project. The closer they feel you are and the more they feel that you are ready to move on, the more they will give you feedback. I had a professor who gave me no feedback for several months on a 100-page draft, but in the last 3 months, she looked at a 300-page draft several times, and she said to me, when you were ready to finish, I gave you all the feedback you needed, but I was too busy when you weren't. And so keep in mind how busy they are. So getting feedback, schedule it. Tell them that you want it. Tell them when you want it. Tell them when you're going to give it to them, and try and work with their schedule and keep working. Keep letting them know that you need their feedback. But don't let that stop you. Don't just say, I haven't done anything since you gave me feedback. Okay, what to do when you get feedback? The most important thing about feedback is it's just information about how to move forward. It is not, even if you're in your worst possible nightmares are coming true and a faculty member is personally attacking you, what you need to do is take that as information about how to proceed. This is a burnt out filament if it's bad feedback, right? It's just something that tells you that this formulation of the problem and the project isn't working, so you move forward. Maybe that means finding a new committee member. Maybe it just means rewriting part of your draft. But whatever it is that you're doing, take that feedback as information that you're going to use. It's a learning experience, no more. If you emotionally distance yourself from it, you're in much better position to persevere and finish despite any problems that you're having with them. Any questions about that? Okay. Bureaucratic matters.
Hello?
Hello, yes. Oh.
Hi. I had a question about this last piece that we did,
sure,
about getting feedback.
Yeah,
this is
sure.
Where I had a major problem and a major roadblock.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, exactly what you're saying, trying to get the attention off my chair to read my proposal so
mm-hmm.
I could get the feedback and I could move forward. And, you know,
right.
He kept saying that, give me 2 weeks, and I'll get to it. And like you said, you know, he's extremely busy. And then I guess I emailed him saying that, you know, it's the end of the semester and the other committee members will be bogged down with finals and grading. So why don't we try and schedule the hearing for, like, the third week of April? And then he immediately said, okay, I will read it by Friday and get back to you. And I think I just saw the email. He replied, so I didn't get a chance to see it because I had to, you know, call
mm-hmm.
The conference. But I think that's what did it when I gave him, like, a deadline. First, I was trying
right.
to be too patient, and then I think he's probably done it when I go back. Or, you know, if he hasn't, then it's like, what do? I just keep on giving him, like, a schedule, like you said, because I really want him to help me to move forward. What do I do?
Well, it's always a trick, but if you get them in the habit of responding to you, and if
mm-hmm.
you get them, if you tell them schedules, if you're always polite, if you make it a pleasure to work with you, then they're going to work with you. One of the personal interests of your faculty committee that I didn't talk about, but I should have, one of their personal interests is their standing in the faculty of their school, and it adds to the school wants to graduate people because it looks good when your school graduates people and it helps you get better students.
Mm-hmm.
Because the school wants to graduate people, the individual professors want to graduate people, and professors have rosters of graduate students that they're working with. It is to their advantage in terms of personal satisfaction and sort of political pull within the department to have students who finish. It looks good, and they want you to finish. So
mm-hmm.
if you can make it easier for them and let them know that you are going to work that you are going to be somebody who's going to pay off for them in their terms of their personal interest in having you graduate, that will help. So saying, I'm ready, when can we schedule it, that's what you have to do. And, of course, there is always the possibility of a pathological situation where a professor won't ever respond. And if that continues and persists over an extended period, you have to seriously think about getting a new committee member. But first, you want to try what you said. You give them schedules. You say, look, the semester is coming to an end. I need to do this before the semester. If it doesn't work this semester, in the beginning of the next semester, you say, look, I need to make sure that this happens this semester. Can we schedule it for, you know, the second week of the semester so that it happens?
Mm-hmm.
And if they put it off, then you at least are boxing them into it. And the more you can get them to say, yes, I recognize your schedule helps me, it's the best you can do. So I don't know, you know, what to say exactly about how to get your professor to do it, but it sounds like your experience with saying, I have to do it before the end of the semester, did work to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And another question. As a guideline to get feedback, how much time should we allow them, 1 to 2 weeks or more? Like you said, sometimes they don't get back for months, you know?
Well,
what's
it
a
depends.
Good timeline?
It depends on the size of the work you're sending them. And it would, I think it's good to request feedback. If you say, before you send them the work, you say, I want to send you this next week, next month. When can you get me feedback within a week or 2 weeks? You know, can we set a schedule? I think that's the best you can do, and hope that that works. As I say, they're going to give you feedback depending on any number of factors, including their sense of your progress towards completion. And the more you give them the sense that you're quickly moving towards completion, the more they're going to give you quick feedback.
Oh, so in other words, we can manage it.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Try and manage them. That is exactly my point.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. Okay, so I'm going to go on to six. I only have two parts more, and I see that I only have 7 minutes, so I'm just going to dash through these. Bureaucratic matters. There are many bureaucratic aspects to your dissertation, and it helps immensely to know them. Knowing your timeline helps. If you can know that you have to file on a certain date, you can make plans that accurately guide you. So knowing the time, what day you have to file, knowing whether there are any preliminary pre-filing things that you have to do and when they occur, knowing your timeline helps immensely. If you plan according to your deadlines and feedback you want to get, given how busy your faculty committee is, you want to leave in time enough for them to work on a piece. So if you know when your deadline is, you can say, well, I need to get this 3 weeks before, to my committee 3 weeks before, so they have 2 weeks to review it, and then I have a week to respond or whatever. But knowing your timeline is very important. Second, know what bureaucratic hurdles exist. The better you are at looking at the different bureaucratic hurdles that are out there and by handling them early, the less you're putting yourself in a situation where you're frantically running around in the end in a panic trying to file papers that you didn't know about. And that can just save tremendous wear and tear. Bureaucratic stuff is it's a hassle, but it's never really difficult. And if you can do it early, then when it's time to finish your dissertation and you have that paragraph that you have to write that your advisor really wanted, then you can focus on that paragraph rather than thinking that you have to file some paper. The most important bureaucratic hurdle is human subject protocols. If you're doing any sort of empirical study with human subjects, your school is almost sure to have a human subject protocol board or of some sort. Know what they want, know how to work with that, and handle it early. The sooner you get aware of what the human subjects protocol people want, the better you can refine your method to suit it, and it can actually provide you as a model for how to do your human subjects and how to do your methods. Know your formatting and style guidelines for submission, knowing what kind of paper you need, knowing how big your margins are, knowing what typefaces to use, knowing what line spacing to use. These are lots of details that if you look into months ahead of time, you do all your writing in that format, or in a format that you can easily turn into these, a format that satisfies these things, and you're not frantically trying to set the margins at the end. You've got it all set up months in advance. It can save you tremendous time. It can save you the cost of hiring an editor if you've set stuff in APA format months earlier. So if you know the formatting and style guidelines, that can just save you tremendous pain. Finally, file early. If you plan on filing early and you leave some room for error in your planning scheme, then you are going to either finish early and have that joy, or you are going to be well set up for finishing on time when the unexpected occurs. So plan early. Any questions about bureaucratic matters? I know that I only have 3 minutes left for the last section. Okay, I'm going to dash through the last section, and I know I didn't say anything about qualitative versus quantitative, and I remember that I think it was Suzanne mentioned something about that.
Okay, Dave, if everyone is not rushing off to something after the teleconference, mm-hmm. we can extend it 5 minutes or so if everyone wants to talk about anything else or have any other questions. So it doesn't necessarily have to be 60 minutes, just that way so that if anybody is scheduling
right.
something afterwards. But again, this will be recorded, so if you have to end the call and miss a part of it, you can always listen to the recording later. So go ahead.
Okay, great. So point seven, sources of assistance other than your committee. Obviously, your committee is tremendously valuable to you. They will give you advice. They will give you guidance. They will give you a lot of recommendations about what to do. They will do often tremendous amounts of editing for you. But they're busy, as we've been talking about. There are other resources available that can really help you. And the first that I recommend the most highly is your university may well have resources available to you, a writing support center, an academic writing center. Tremendously valuable to have somebody help you on your writing. It can help you improve your work. It can help you move more smoothly. It can help you focus your efforts. If your university has a writing center, an academic writing center, or writing support services, they're really worth using. Every one of my clients that I talk to that uses these things, values it and benefits from it. So I recommend looking into that. They can help you in all dimensions of your draft. They'll give you feedback. It's great stuff. Also, research assistance from the research librarians at your library. I'm sure you have a librarian. Librarians are tremendous at answering your questions, and they love to do the research. They're not librarians because they want to, like, file books. They're librarians because they're psyched about libraries and they're psyched about research. So if you ask them to help you with the research, chances are they'll be excited to show you different tools that can help you and give you some guidance on how to use them. It's a good resource that you can take those are some of the good resources that your universities will have available. You also have your peers, and it can be, great to get individual help and to exchange readings of work with your peers. That's a great way to get feedback, get an idea of how your work will be received by somebody who is reading similar material to you and is working on similar ideas as you. It can be a great source of feedback and a great source of emotional support to work with a peer and to have that exchange. Obviously, it takes work to read their work if you're exchanging work with them, but it takes them effort to read your work. So if you recognize that and can appreciate the value in that exchange, then you can benefit from that kind of support. And one great idea that a lot of people a well-known idea of having a dissertation group, having a group of peers who are all working together and working in similar situations. If you can get such a group together, you can get a lot of different support and feedback. You can get opportunities to talk about different problems and ideas about how to move forward. So dissertation groups can be invaluable. There are people who have a lot of the same experiences, the same knowledge, and they have great insight into approaching things in different ways than you. Researchers, well, of course, I mentioned research librarians at your research library, but there are professional researchers out there, and this is now I'm reaching the end of my list. All these people are now professionals available out there. You can have people gather data for you and use search engines and whatnot, and that can save you time, and then you can use that time to review what they've done and think about what it means to you and to pick out the best stuff. All is a possibility. Statisticians. Statisticians are invaluable for those of you doing quantitative work, unless you're a statistician yourself. There are lots of statisticians available for work. I would recommend getting a statistician with whom you can talk about what you're doing and whose explanations you understand. I have worked with clients who have gotten statistical work done that was essentially meaningless because the statistician just ran a bunch of different tests on the data without sort of focusing anything and didn't really answer the questions that the researcher had. So you want to, when you get a statistician, to work with somebody who can work with you and talk to you in a reasonable way so that you set up the statistics well and you set up the study well according to good statistical thinking. So get your statistics. I guess one lesson would be to try and get your statistician in line before you have actually done the data gathering, because the statistician may have ideas that substantively help defining your study. There are editors out there, and you can get editors to do a number of different tasks. I think that there are a lot of very valuable tasks that an editor can do. Content editing is editing to look at your subject matter, to look at what you're doing, to look at your logical coherence, to look at your logical structure and whatnot. It's the most general kind of feedback that you can get. It can be tremendously useful if you're having trouble focusing on a thesis or if you're having trouble seeing aspects of your work. This is a chance to get a different person's perspective on what the work looks like and what it means in general. This is how somebody is interpreting the work as a whole, so it can be very valuable in that sense. Copy editing tends to look more at the sentences and trying to make the sentences work within the structure of the study. Very good at getting ambiguities and whatnot. Finally, there's proofreading and formatting, which can often be combined with copy editing. But this is just setting things in, for example, the style of your dissertation will have to be in, be it APA or ASA or Chicago Manual or MLA or whatever it is. You can get somebody who will review the document to check it for, you know, whether the margins are right, whether the headings are right, whether the whether numbers are expressed in proper form, whether that be digits or written out, etc. So those are the different kinds of editing that one can get. And finally, there are coaches like me, people who are trying to help you work with the dissertation and find a good practice for working on your dissertation and a good way of interacting in it. Coaches are focused in helping you set up feedback patterns or helping you set up schedules, helping you set up work patterns, in helping you interact with your work in a different way and give you feedback and support on problems that you're working on. I think of often the metaphor of an athletic coach is actually very appropriate for work that I do. Everybody I work with is different, and some people need to some athletes out there are talented and they work hard, but they have bad confidence, and so they perform well in competition. And some athletes are talented and have good confidence, but they don't work out and they need somebody to make them work out all the time. And some athletes work out very hard and have good attitude, but aren't particularly talented, and so their bodies break down and they need somebody to manage the work schedule so that they break down. Right, all of these dimensions can sort of pertain to a dissertation writer's process. Some writers are having trouble finding meaning in their project. Some writers are having trouble because they're you know, unhappy and struggling with depression. Some writers are having trouble because they have problems in their family which take a lot of time, and all of these different things need to be approached differently. So a coach can help you try and find a way to get your dissertation practice to best utilize your strengths and to mitigate the problematic aspects that are there. And I think that wraps up my outline, and I will almost wrap up this. I think it was Suzanne who mentioned having qualitative data and moving on to wanting to add quantitative data. And what I think about in general, focus is that you should try not to be too ambitious. I think expediency is important. Qualitative data often gets sort of a bad rap for not being scientific enough, but I happen to love qualitative data, and I think that it's very powerful. And I say this from the perspective of somebody whose main interest sort of philosophically is in questions of epistemology and philosophy of science. Qualitative data talks about what is possible. Quantitative data, in particular what we call inferential statistics, talks about what is likely. And when you do a quantitative study with inferential statistics, what you're doing is you're gathering hundreds or dozens or thousands of cases, and you're looking for proportions and probabilities, and you're looking for a chance to say something like, well, we noticed that there was a big difference in test scores between rich kids and poor kids, and so we're going to presume that there is a causal relationship between wealth and, or that there is some factor, causal factor related to wealth, which affects test scores. Right? It makes a generalization that you can then say this is going to be true often. And that's a tremendously powerful thing. And this is, of course, what most of science runs on. Most of science runs on saying, well, yeah, if we, you know, explode this gasoline and air mixture inside this contained chamber, it will drive a piston with this much force, so we need steel that's this strong to capture it, et cetera, right? And it's a probabilistic task, science is. But it's uncertain, and it is a question of we are working with our best hypotheses that have not been disproven. This is sort of based on a model of science developed by the philosopher Karl Popper, the German scientist, philosopher of science Karl Popper, who wrote The Logic of Scientific Discovery. And Popper's premise of what science is and how it works is sort of the dominant paradigm of how a lot of science is practiced today, the idea of the null hypothesis, which many of us are familiar from inferential statistics, is essentially derived from Popper's premises. So it's a very powerful view, but it's also imperfect. Qualitative data, by contrast, is often, you know, poo-pooed as not being scientific enough because it isn't probabilistic. If we find one case of something, that doesn't mean that we can make any claims about it occurring ever again. That being said, it does mean that we can claim that it has occurred, and this is a very powerful statement too. And so qualitative data, which is often poo-pooed, if it's presented well, if it's presented in terms of saying, here is a possible explanation for other cases beyond this one. For example, a qualitative study might interview 10 people, and one of those people might say, I became this because, you know, I saw a bumblebee when I was a kid. And we cannot then demonstrate that everybody who became that saw bumblebees when they were kids, but we can say one possible causal path is that by seeing a bumblebee when you're a kid, you become this, and we have then generated based on evidence in the world, that's out there, based on empirical data, we have generated one possible causal understanding or explanation of how the world works. And this is a hypothesis that then is the sort of the foundation of what can be tested by some other inferential statistic. So qualitative data provides a wonderful set of opportunities to open up your work to a side of science that gets somewhat neglected and to valuable conclusions that don't depend on probability. We know that the case of qualitative data, we know that the event occurred. We know that the singular event occurred, and that's enough. That's a very important thing. To go back to Karl Popper, Popper based his model of science on the idea that if we go out into the world and we collect data, we can never prove that the data we have collected is comprehensive. And this is essentially following David Hume and what Kant came to know as Hume's problem. But if I go out in the world and, to use a common example, I'm gathering information on swans, and I see 100 swans, and they're all white, then I can make a claim that all swans are white, but that claim actually isn't necessarily true, and I only have to find one black swan to show that it's not true that all swans are white. So Karl Popper said, we can never prove the truth of something based on gathering data, but we can prove the falsehood of it. The other way of taking that, though, is that we have proved the possibility of something. So by finding the one black swan, we have proved the possibility that there are swans that are not white. And this is sort of the face that is qualitative data. By finding a study, by finding an exemplar, we say it is possible that, we have shown it's possible that, which can be used to disprove any number of points, but also can be the foundation for other hypotheses that we test. So it's quantitative studies are looking to say swans are mostly white. Most swans are white. We got a 99.9% chance of swans being white, or whatever the number is. Qualitative data is looking to say, is it possible? This is possible. Two different sides of the same sort of logical process. So I don't know, Suzanne, I'm hoping that it was Suzanne who had the question about qualitative and quantitative, or the comment about wanting to add quantitative to her qualitative. But hopefully that at least addresses some of your issues on that. And I think that's
sorry,
all.
I was going to say that's really helpful.
Oh, good. Excellent. So that's all I have to say. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Actually, it's Suzanne again. I had one other question.
Oh, sure.
You mentioned writing to an audience.
Mm-hmm.
What, in my situation, I'm in an interdisciplinary program.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any advice with regard to that particular situation where I'm combining different fields in my thesis? And so I think it is a little bit more tricky when you're doing interdisciplinary work.
Right.
So to write to it, right to an audience.
To who? So who's my audience is the question, and I guess the problem is somewhat, even if you assume a knowledgeable reader, well, one knowledgeable reader may be knowledgeable about this, but not about that, and the other knowledgeable reader may be knowledgeable about that, but not about this, and so which do I include? That sort of thing. It's a tough question, and I think that there are sort of three ways that I would think about it. One is there a journal out there that you think, or maybe a publisher who you think does work that your dissertation would be suited to? And if so, can you use that journal or that publisher to help you focus your ideas on, I'd like my audience to be the kind of people who buy books from this people, or the kind of people who select this journal. Alternatively, you can imagine a scholar, idealize an audience, say, these are people who are interested in this, and they're going to know, they're going to know a lot about one of these, but they won't be offended if I give them some background in that field, and they won't know as much about these other things, and so they'll need this much background to make it work. but, you know, sort of an idealized audience that has characteristics in a way close to your own. Other interdisciplinary scholars who are trying to blend similar disciplines in similar ways. And the final option would be to just think about your committee. If the three of them, or I'm assuming it's three, but if the three of them have each a different field, then it has to be some sort of amalgamation of the each. Well, you know, Joe is going to need to know this and will accept this level of explanation on the stuff he doesn't know about or does the stuff he does know about. And Gene is going to need this and that and so on. So those would be my three suggestions about trying to find an audience that, or trying to imagine an audience to whom to write. Does that make sense? Or did any of those resonate?
No, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Great, great.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.